And good evening, everyone. So good to see you again tonight and from our time of the supper together. And it's just really good to be back together. So thank you very, very much for being here. And thank you, Jeff, and your group for the great job you do with the music and the worship. I know you folks appreciate that very much. That makes a huge difference, doesn't it, in how we approach worship and having folks who really know how to lead in worship. And so it's just it's a great, great experience together. Well, this morning we left our man Job in kind of a bad news, good news situation. Oh yeah, and by the way, if the microphone falls off again tonight as it did this morning, I was the only person in the building who did not know my microphone had fallen off. And so until kind of towards the end, and I saw this thing kind of growing out of my chest, and I realized that was a microphone growing out of me. So if it does it again, why, everybody just kind of shout out in unison, your microphone fell off, and it's okay, but the guys have it all under control. They will take care of it. We left our man Job in kind of this bad news, good news situation where the very bad news was the obvious fact that he had gone from being the wealthiest, greatest man among all the people in the East to a guy who lost everything in a single day. But the good news was he was still determined to be faithful to God in spite of that, that he would not blame God. He would not accuse God. He celebrated, he remembered how God had blessed in the good times, and he affirmed that he would hold faithful to God in the bad times. Satan, of course, had confidently predicted to God that if God would allow these things to come on Job, if God would remove his hand of blessing and protection from him, Job would curse God to his face. But Job doesn't do this. He mourns deeply with his losses, but he does not accuse God. In fact, he worships God, as we have sung about earlier here this evening. He's been broken, but he has remained faithful, and we're left saying, good for you, Job. Well done. Attaboy, you showed Satan. But then Satan says, we're not done yet. Satan reasons that, yeah, okay, I'll concede the point. Job has done better than I thought he would. He's remained true. He's been through a lot. But he seems to reason, surely anyone can pass a severe test once. Anyone can, following the worst day of their lives, then turn around and have the best day and kind of pull themselves up by their bootstraps and grit their teeth and say, okay, it's times are tough, but I'm going to plow through and we're going to hold steady and we're going to make it through this thing. And so Satan begins to plot and to scheme, well, what if we up the ante? What if we turn the heat up on Job even more? And what if we inflict even greater pain on him? How will he fare then if he is not just once broken, but twice broken? And so we come into chapters 2 and 3. Chapter 2 begins with identical words, verbatim, from the earlier parts of chapter 1 about this strange scene. The angels come, present themselves before the Lord, and Satan kind of comes strutting in too. And God says, well, Satan, where have you been? Where have you come from? And Satan says, well, I've just been out roaming around doing what Satan people do. It's what I do. And again, God challenges Job, or Satan, with the faithfulness of Job. And he points out to him that even though these terrible things have happened to him, he said he still maintains his integrity. And so Satan now decides to heighten the challenge. He picks up, and we'll just go ahead and read a few verses here, beginning with verse 4 of chapter 2. Satan says, skin for skin, A man will give all he has for his own life, but stretch out your hand and strike his flesh and bones, and he will surely curse you to your face. The Lord said to Satan, "Very well then, he's in your hands, but you must spare his life." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and afflicted Job with painful sores from the soles of his feet to the top of his head. Then Job took a piece of broken pottery and scraped himself with it as he sat among the ashes. His wife said to him, "Are you still holding on to your integrity? Curse God and die." He replied, "You're talking like a foolish woman. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble?" And in all this, Job did not sin in what he said. And so here it is. The new challenge from Satan to the Lord is, okay, you let me take away everything he had. But what if we attack Job personally, physically? Then he will surely curse you to your face. And so again, God accepts the challenge and says, "I put him into your hands." But again, God draws a line. There is a limit. You may not take his life. You cannot kill Job. That is out of bounds. And so we have this most pitiful image of Job, afflicted with painful sores from the soles of his feet to the top of his head. We don't know what these sores are. We have no idea. Some say they were boils. Some say, you know, some kind of ulcers. We have no idea, but it's all we know for sure is that they are horrendous, because later on, Job is described as being hideous to look at and in great, great pain. I mean, this is suffering. He is disfigured. He is not only once broken with the loss of all he had, now twice broken with the loss of his health and great physical suffering. And then, bless her heart, Mrs. Job comes in and enters the story. She asks a question. "Are you still holding to your integrity? Can't you see that God is against you? What further evidence do you need? Job, wake up. Look at all you've lost. Job, look at what you have become. You are hideous." And her advice is, do yourself a favor, curse God, and die. Now, I'm sure that Mrs. Job was really a very lovely person in her day. But in this moment, she doesn't really present herself very well, does she? She has been seen as harsh and unbelievably cruel and unsympathetic and cold and angry with the whole thing. But actually, there are those scholars in this field who have proposed the idea that maybe we've been ourselves too harsh on Job's wife. That maybe we have misunderstood her words. Because they say it's possible that what Job's wife meant in the words that sound to us is just very, very cold and stark. But what the meaning of her words was, that behind this is a sincere desire to help Job find a way out of his misery. And they theorize that she is advocating to Job, "Job, it's hopeless. This is unbearable. Do yourself a favor. If you curse God, surely his anger will strike you dead in an instant. And at least you will be out of your misery." As harsh as it sounds, what some of these commentators propose is that Job's wife is advocating suicide by God. Provoke God so he will do you the favor of killing you and ending this horrendous suffering. But Job doesn't flinch at all. He doesn't consider that for a second. He just says, you're talking like a foolish woman. You're talking nonsense. He has worshiped God through his time of loss. And now, and because of his devotion to God, he sees this new suffering as something that should not change that devotion, should not kill that devotion now. Yes, new suffering has come. Things have gotten worse. But that shouldn't hinder his devotion to God. And he sees no reason to turn his back on God and to curse God and to blame God for all of this. So he asks the question, shall we accept good from God and not trouble? Now, Job assumes, because of the culture of his day and their understandings of God, that all of these troubles have come upon him from God. He assumes that to be the case, that God has for some reason turned his hand against him and is doing these things. But actually, he has no idea that it's Satan who's doing these things to him. Yes, there's this challenge, and there's this uncomfortable conversation and all of this, and God has given permission. God has removed his hand. But God is not the one actually inflicting the pain and suffering. But he says, I trusted him in the good times. I will trust him in the bad times. I think it's interesting and worth noting that Job does not presume that just because he has enjoyed God's favor in the past with a blessed life of health and wealth and family and status and happiness, he does not assume that that means God owes that to him. God is still sovereign, he reasons. And the Lord gives, and the Lord takes away. And he is still God. And I will still serve him and worship him. Now, that belief that God is still in all of this and all those things, it doesn't lessen his pain any, but it does help to give him perspective on the business that I just touched on briefly this morning of the realities of life in this fallen world. We all long for a perfect world of where there's justice and there's no more disaster and there's no more evil and there's no more pain. But that's not the reality of the world we live in. The world we know today is not the world as God created it. We live in the world that has been destroyed by sin. It's been warped by sin. It's been damaged by sin. It's been corrupted by sin. And so we live in that world, but we long for the world yet to come when God brings all things to completion and the new heaven and the new earth, and then Eden is restored, and the earth and all of the cosmos is as God had originally created it to be. Job probably wouldn't articulate it that way, but that seems to be the essence. He seems to get it. Life here in this world is not always going to be fair, and God doesn't owe me anything. God is God. I am not. And so here again, in all of this we read, Job did not sin in what he said. For a second time, God's confidence in Job has been vindicated. For the second time, Job's faithfulness to God has proved Satan to be a liar. Because Satan's whole premise is, if we do these, if I'm allowed to do these things to him, he will curse God. But Job doesn't do it. And that is what Satan is, you know. He's a professional liar. He's the deceiver. He is the one who plants thoughts in our minds and things in front of us and things around us to deceive us and draw us away. But it's all lies. That's all he does. He constantly lies. We're told that in Scripture. God is vindicated in his trust in Job because Satan has again been proved to be a liar, which is really the essence of why God even accepts the challenge from Job in the first place. It's not because God wants necessarily to test Job just for the sake of testing Job. He allows the test of Job to go forth in order to prove to Satan and to prove to everyone else who's going to hear the story that Satan is a liar. Job did not curse God. He did not do those things that Satan had adamantly insisted he would do. He is the liar. And again, after this second test, God is still able to say of Job, there is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright. He fears God and shuns evil, and he still maintains his integrity. And wouldn't it be nice if the story ended there? But we still got 40 chapters to go. And in chapter 3 is where Job now begins to crack. And we start to see what's really brewing in Job's heart. The pain is too great. And I know here at the end of chapter 2, we're introduced to his three friends who come and visit him. But I'm just going to skip that for now because that's what we're going to talk about tomorrow night. About the conversations with the three friends. But when he moves on into chapter 3, we see that the pain now is becoming too great, and the suffering is going on too long, and the grief is just too deep. And Job speaks, and he actually expresses three wishes, and all of them have to do with the fact he wishes he were not alive. In verse 1 in chapter 3, it says, Job cursed the day of his birth. He wished he had never been born. Why did I even have to come into this world if this is what was in store for me? But then quickly after that, in verse 11, he kind of shifts it a bit. And he says, why did I not perish at birth? He's allowing for that, okay, I was born, but why did I have to survive my infancy? Why couldn't I have just died so very young before I had a chance to know all of these sufferings? But I was born, and I did survive. And then in verse 20, he's contemplating the realities of his life that's now in his existence. And he says, why is life given to the bitter of soul, to those who long for death that does not come? He's saying, I wish I'd never been born. Okay, if I had to be born, I wish I'd have died young. Okay, if I didn't die young, I sure wish my life would end now. Life is being forced on me against my will. I so wish I could just die and be out of my misery. You know, Job has done so well up to this point. I mean, he's remained faithful, he's remained strong, he's been a role model for us, but now as he begins to crack, he begins to vent some thoughts and some emotions that reflect the deep frustration and the deep anguish that's really building up inside of him. And in one way, we've been so proud of Job up to now, but at this point, we kind of begin to feel a little disappointed in him. Job, don't go there. No, Job, don't do it. You've done so well. Don't give up. Don't blow it now. Don't start talking foolish talk and venting these kinds of things. Job, just keep remembering the joys and the blessings that God gave you. Remember the wealth you used to enjoy and the health you used to enjoy and the status and your kids, your family. Remember what a happy group you were. Remember the wonderful things God has said about you, that there's no one else on earth like you, and that you're blameless and you're upright, that you're a man who fears God and shuns evil. And even after all of your suffering, Job, remember how God bragged about you to Satan and pointed out that you had maintained your integrity. Don't cave in. Remember all these things God has been saying about you. But that's just the problem. Do you remember? Do you see the problem? The problem is Job has not heard anything God has said about him. Job has no idea what God thinks of him. God has been talking about Job, but God has not uttered a single peep to Job. All of the conversations about what a great guy Job is has gone on behind his back out of earshot. And Job has no idea of what God has been saying about him to Satan, and the confidence God has in him, and the affirmation God has been giving him. And so what we see here in this moment, Job actually enters a third phase of testing and trial. Job is being subjected to a test that Satan did not initiate. It's a test that God on his own initiated. It's the test of the silent treatment. God is giving Job the silent treatment. Now, the silent treatment's an interesting thing because we mere mortals have this very curious idea that somehow giving somebody the silent treatment is a really effective way of communicating with them. Might be a tiny flaw in our logic, but we buy into that and we believe it wholeheartedly. If I offend you, the best way you can let me know that I've offended you and exactly how I've offended you and how deeply I've offended you is for you to refuse to speak to me. And I'll understand what all of that means. We think this is a great way of communicating our displeasure. Of course, we really know it does absolutely nothing to solve the problem, but it sure makes us feel better about ourselves. Like, I showed him. I got back at him. He's the one hurting now because I'm not talking to him. Now, I don't want to get off in the weeds here, and I'm always really careful when I start touching on things like husbands and wives and men-women relationships and all that, but just to point out something that at least all the women know, but in case you don't, ladies, the silent treatment doesn't work on us guys. We interpret silence as a good thing. If you're not talking about it, there is no problem. There is no issue. And so we're, okay, well, I thought she was upset, but she's not saying anything, so all is well, life is good. Where's my TV remote? Let's get back to business here. And guys, I would just say, you know, for us, I'm as guilty as, I mean, I'm one of us too. You know, have to remind myself sometimes, don't wait for the 2x4 to hit me up the side of the head before I wake up and kind of pay attention, yeah, to what's going on and maybe what signals are there that I'm oblivious to. But of course, God's version of the silent treatment isn't like ours. His isn't the petty, juvenile, cold shoulder, I'll show you kind of thing. God's version of the silent treatment is very, very different. It is the painful reality of being in a situation where we desperately want to hear from God, but God refuses to speak. And that is painful. And that is frustrating. And that is infuriating. I mentioned to the Sunday school group this morning when we were kind of doing this introductory thing that I, when I was just still in high school, began to have a sense of the Lord calling me to ministry, but that there was no specific parameter on that. There was no specific thing, oh, I'm calling you to be a pastor or a missionary or whatever it is. You know, it was just a call to life, a vocational ministry of service to him, service to the broader church, whatever that meant. Now, what I didn't tell you this morning, because we'll be shorter on time, but in reality, in my younger days, and especially when I was young and actually in ministry, that was not good news for me. I didn't know how to interpret that. I didn't know what to do with it. It was like God just gave me enough information to know he was going to require a life of service with me, but he refused to let me know any of the details of what that meant, or how to prepare for it, or how to plan, what to do, where to go. And when I was in my very first ministry assignment, I was a pastor of a of a rural church, actually out in the middle of Kansas, of all places, which was a very interesting, a great but interesting experience. Something just didn't feel right. I didn't know. Is this God's will for me or not? Am I in the right place? And I remember driving out across the highway, coming back into our little town one afternoon. And I was just mad at God. And I actually told God he was a coward. That was the word I actually used. I said it out loud. God, you're a coward. Why are you afraid to talk to me? Why won't you let me know the direction of your will? If it's to do what I'm doing now, okay, I'm good with that. But I sure need your help to do it. But if it's something else, I need to know that too. And it's this deafening silence. And that just irritated me to no end. And it was eating me up. Because I had no idea, how do I determine God's will when he won't talk to me? It wasn't too long after that I was in a pastor's conference. And we had a guest speaker coming in and talking to all the guys for two or three days of meetings and seminars and things. And the guest speaker was actually an old college professor of mine that I'd had in college. But he got to talking in one of those sessions, and I don't think it was a planned topic. I think he just got off on it in response to a question somebody had asked. And he explained something that I'd never heard him talk about in college. I was thinking, where was this information? That sure would have been handy to know back then, but somehow, if I heard it, I completely missed it. But he got to talking about this business of discerning God's will. And he said, we have made a tragic mistake, many of us, in our Christian lives, in how we picture the will of God. Because what we have done, we have taken the image of a tiny little bullseye target that is set up 500 yards away, and we're given a bow and arrow, and we're told you have one shot. Hit it, and bing, 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 you win, you're in, you have found God's will, and you're set. If you miss it, you've missed it. Doesn't mean you've lost your salvation, but you will never know God's true, perfect will for you, and your life is going to be lived at a second or third tier level of what God really had in store for you. I think, well, yeah, that's kind of what I was always taught to believe. I don't, never in those words, but kind of by implication and the way I was counseled and advised, that's kind of the way it was. Now, in the New Testament, it talks about sin, the word sin meaning to miss the mark. But trying to discern God's will is not sin. It's just good, godly people trying to figure out what God wants them to do. And so the metaphor, the image, doesn't match that we've kind of carried over into this thing about God's will. And so the professor said, here's a much healthier way of viewing God's will. He just said, God's will is not some tiny target that you have one shot at. He said, God's will for your life is a road. It's a path for the journey. And he said, when you're driving along this road, the issue is not which lane you've chosen to drive in. The question is, are you still on the road? And so he said, so much of God's... Now, there are times God will be very, very specific. Say, take this turn, do this. I know you weren't expecting it. But in those times, he will be very clear to us in that. But for most of the time, in my experience, I realized, and over the years, that has been my safety net in facing major decisions, whether they are career ministry decisions or other more personal things, where I'm really wanting to know God's will. He so often has reminded me, okay, now let's examine this. Are you still on my path? Are you still with me? You've not gone off in the ditch, have you? You've not gone off in the weeds, have you? No, we're still on the path. But Lord, which this path has five different lanes to it, and I don't know which lane to be in. Which lane is the center of your will? And it finally dawned on me, the Holy Spirit finally got through to me, where God was, by his silence, saying, I'm good with any of them, as long as you're on the road and headed the right direction. I'm good with any of those lanes. And so my prayer long ago in making those major decisions of trying to discern God's will ceased to be, Lord, show me what to do. My prayer became, okay, Lord, I think I might be changing lanes up here. Is that okay with you? The car I drive now has one of those lane deals, you know, where if you start to drift into the other lane, it beeps at you, beep, 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 you know. So, you know, it's like, okay, God, I'm listening for the beeps. Okay, here we go. I'm changing lanes. Are you paying attention? You know, and I'm listening for the beep. And if the beep is silent, okay, I guess I'm all right. I'm still in God's will. And it finally dawned on me when I was facing some decisions, in particular on some career things and where to go to do certain things. And God never spoke to me, but by his silence, it was like he seemed to impress on me, look, all three of these options are good. I'm good with any of those three. You pick which one you want to do, and I will bless you in it if you're faithful to me. And so it's this idea that his silence actually became a way of communicating. Oswald Chambers, writing in My Utmost for His Highest, says in effect that sometimes God gives us the silent treatment because he is trusting us with his silence. Chambers says, when you cannot hear God, you will find that he has trusted you in the most intimate way possible with absolute silence. Not a silence of despair, but one of pleasure, because he saw that you could withstand an even greater revelation. Oswald's point in that section of the devotional is that sometimes God teaches us with loud, clear direction and voice. Other times he teaches us with his silence, because the silence requires us to trust him. And so my prayer in many situations has been, okay, Lord, I think I'm going to go this way. If this is not where you want me, hit me with the 2x4. Do something, send somebody, put up the red flags, give me the signals, give me that uneasiness, whatever it is. But otherwise, I will assume by your silence that your blessing is on this and you're okay with it. And then I can guarantee you what happens afterwards, after in the new role or whatever the situation is, every single time. There has then come the peace of assurance. God says, yeah, I'm still with you. I change lanes with you. You're still in my road. You're still on my path. We're all still headed the right direction. Let's drive in this lane for a while and then see where it goes. Sometimes God is trusting us with his silence in the silent treatment. But then other times he kind of goes to an opposite extreme. Sometimes God gives us the silent treatment simply because he's waiting for us to shut up and get silent. I had a college a friend of mine who is a college professor, who Sean would know, David Latimer, and some of you folks may know David. But David had a very effective tool for dealing with classroom disruptions. If people would start talking and something happened and all that, and it was starting to get loud, rather than trying to shout over the noise and call the class back to order, he would start talking softer and softer and softer until the students who wanted to hear what was being said, they themselves would turn on the classmates and with peer pressure, hey, shut up, We can't hear him. It was a very effective tool. But David learned the lesson that sometimes the best way to deal with noise is to go silent. And that's sometimes the way it works for us. My wife, Joyce, when we were in high school, she and a friend of hers were at a public swimming pool. And they decided to swim from one side of the pool to the other. Neither one of them are great swimmers. My wife's not a great swimmer, but she likes to swim, and she gets out and paddles around and all that. But her friend was far less confident. But since she was with Joy, she thought, okay, yeah, I'll go with you. Let's make it to the other side. But as they got out into the deep end, her friend panicked. And as panic swimmers do, she instinctively reached out and grabbed hold of Joyce to pull herself above the water. And she literally climbed on top of her and was holding her under the water to keep her own head above water in her panic and her fear. And Joyce got to the point in that where she says she literally realized she was actually going to have to fight for her life because her friend in her panic was going to drown her. And so she fought and she fought and she fought, and she finally escaped and got out and came up and gasping for air. And she yelled at her friend, you've got to calm down. You've got to calm down. You have to calm down. You have to relax. Sometimes God is waiting for us to calm down and relax. When C.S. Lewis was writing in A Grief Observed about his the loss of his wife, Joy, and the deep grief he suffered from that, he wrote something that is just very, very honest and very powerful. He says, where is God? When you're happy, you will be, or so it feels, welcomed with open arms. But go to him when your need is desperate, when all other help is vain. And what do you find? A door slammed in your face, and a sound of bolting and double bolting on the inside. And after that, silence. You may as well turn away. For the longer you wait, the more emphatic the silence will become. And then Lewis asked, why is God so present a commander in our time of prosperity and so very absent a help in our time of trouble? Later in his writings, when Lewis is commenting back on those very harsh words he had to say about God's silence, he says, I was like a drowning man who can't be helped because he clutches and grabs. Sometimes God's silence is communicating to us, you just need to sit down, stop talking, stop ruminating over whatever it is you're obsessing over, your problems or even your pain. Try to get away from that. Focus on other people. Focus on other things. Just sit down and calm down. And just be in my silence for a while. And learn to relax. As difficult as that is when we're stressed or grieved or suffering or in pain. A third way God sometimes uses that silent treatment for us is when he is communicating with us at a deeper level. Many years ago, I heard Anthony Campolo preaching somewhere. He told a story that I've read in many of his writings and have heard him on recordings and podcasts tell. The story of when he was in his younger days as a student, when he had a job as an orderly at a mental health hospital. And he tells of the one patient who was there, a man who had some kind of an experience that was so traumatic and so devastating that emotionally and mentally he had just totally collapsed within himself. And he just simply existed, literally. He gave no sign of communication with anybody at any level. He never spoke. He never responded. He just existed. He would walk around, but he was as if he were a zombie, just lifeless. And he said this man would pass many hours of the day sitting on a particular bench in a particular room, just sitting. But he said one day one of the medical workers, came in and he just happened to sit down on the bench beside the man. And he was just kind of taking a little break, and he was tired. And as he sat down, he kind of gave one of those old man grunts, as my daughter referred to them when I do it. You know, it's just one of those, ugh. And when he did that, the man who had not communicated in any way for years went, ugh. And he looked, he thought, wow, we've never heard him make even a sound. And then it gave him an idea, and he just left. But the next day, he came back, and as he sat down, he kind of let out a deep, quiet groan. And the man let out a deep, quiet groan. And Campolo says that was the beginning of that man's rescue from his trauma, as this worker and this patient developed a relationship of grunts and groans. And they would sit and have conversations, not of words, but of grunts and groans. And over time, eventually, the grunts and the groans became a word here and a word there. And he was led out of the darkness through long periods of treatment. You remember what Romans 8, 26 through 28 says? The Spirit helps us in our weakness. We do not know what we ought to pray for, but the Spirit Himself intercedes for us with groans that words cannot express. Folks, sometimes God is simply groaning with us when our pain is so deep and our questions so big and so perplexing and the suffering so long, we don't even have the words to know how to express them. But he says the Spirit Himself expresses them for us through groans to the Father, because that's all we know how to do. Sometimes God's silence means He's just simply communicating with you at such a deep, deep level that there are no words for it. There is no way to express any of it. In more recent years, several years ago, but more recent times, I was kind of going through some frustrations and some difficulties and just pressures, and things were, it was just not a real pleasant season. You know, those seasons of life, sometimes they're good, sometimes they're not. This was kind of a dark season. And I was home by myself in the middle of the day. And I don't remember what day of the week it was. I don't remember any of that. I just know that somehow I ended up home alone. And it was lunchtime. And I turned on the TV, and I had made myself a sandwich or something. And then I saw, oh, there's a few dishes there that need to be. So I was standing at our kitchen sink washing dishes. I was not thinking anything. You know, again, as guys can do. I mean, I was in total shutdown mode. I mean, I'm perfectly capable of having a totally blank mind. So, you know, don't walk up and say, "What are you thinking?" Because might be I'm not thinking anything. You know, it's kind of hard to admit that. But I was just washing the dishes. And this is the only time in my life I've had this kind of an experience. But as I'm standing there washing the dishes, all of a sudden, I became physically aware. I could physically feel a presence descending into the room. And I knew immediately, even though I'd never had this experience before, this was God's presence. And I literally felt the presence descend. And the tingle came over my whole body in just a sensation I've never had before. And I just stopped what I was doing. I just kind of froze. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know what this meant. I wasn't praying. I wasn't doing anything. But as I stood there, it was just like it became more and more intense. And so the TV was on, and so I just dried my hands and turned the TV off. And then I just stood there in the silence, and that seemed like, no, that's not good enough. And so I just went around the corner into our living room and sat down in an easy chair. But I hadn't been there more than a couple of seconds, and it seemed like, no, that's not good enough. And next thing I knew, I was down on my knees. And after just a few seconds of that, it was, you know, there's just sense, no, that's not good enough. That's not low enough. And so I just laid flat out face down on the floor. And I had no idea what this was. I honestly wondered if I was dying. I thought, is this death? Is there something wrong with me that I don't even know about it? Am I dying? But then I thought, well, no, I can still feel the floor and everything. And, you know, everything looks the same. But I just, the only thing I said in all of that, I just said, Lord, I have no idea what this means. But I'm yours. And this deep, deep presence of God was there very tangibly for not very long, a couple of minutes at most, and then it just gradually lifted. And I went back to doing dishes. But I kept thinking, Lord, what's that about? It was just silence. But it was that, in a sense, that grunting and groaning of the assurance that I understand. I don't need to say anything. You don't need to say anything. Just know I'm here. I don't know if God has given you the silent treatment lately or ever, or maybe doing it now, but don't dismiss it too lightly. Don't read too much into it. Don't make the mistake of assuming that his silence means his absence, because those aren't the same thing at all. If God's been silent for a while, I would just encourage you to explore why. And it may be he's trusting you with an experience. It may be he's waiting for you to calm down. It may be he's just simply communicating at a level that language cannot even begin to express. Lord, help us to learn to thank you even for your silence. And so, Lord, whatever it is you have to say to us by not speaking, help us, Lord, to have the trust in you to respond with obedience and can continue to affirm our faith in you and to stay in the path and keep walking with you. Amen.